The Salem witch trials resulted in the executions of 19 people and, for the record, two dogs. The crime, witchcraft in Massachusetts. All this happened back in 1692, and here we are 324 years later, and we're still interested. But why did it happen? What possessed so many people in Salem to start making the wildest accusations about each other? And what does all this have to tell us now, 324 years later? Maybe a lot. With us now is Pulitzer Prize-winning author Stacy Schiff, who speaks at the library Monday evening about her book, The Witches, Salem 1692. The book is now out in paperback. And Stacy, welcome. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, why should we care all these years later? What does this story have to tell us today, Stacy?
Well, I think especially when we're living in similarly anxious and dislocated times, it's a rather relevant story. And I think Salem stands as a kind of guardrail about what happens when you do go around demonizing your fellow citizens and leveling accusations and trafficking in untruths. A lot of what happens in Salem happens because people fervently believe in witchcraft, but at a certain point, a lot of what happens happens because of grudge-bearing and the thirst, the great unquenchable thirst for justice. And getting back at your neighbor, I should add.
Yeah. Well, maybe one central question that hovers in the air here is this one. How do good people, you know, reasonable people, do such great evil to one another? You spent a whole lot of time wrestling with this. Give us your best shot.
You want me to just answer that in 20 seconds,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, 20. Yeah.
You know, I guess that one of the interesting things to me about Salem is that all criticism of what is happening, any sane voice, goes quiet that year. It's a very quick moment, I should say. The entire episode takes 10 months from beginning to end. And the voices of dissent are not heard. During that time, no one who's accused of a witch, no one's family sues for slander after that kind of accusation. They just go quiet. And it's some time before any critic will speak up. And I think it's, you know, it's baby steps, as is often the case with something like this. Someone thinks someone else will take the initiative. It becomes very dangerous to register any kind of criticism of the witchcraft court. And it's infinitely easier to accuse than it is to stand up and enter any kind of protest against what's happening. So I think that part of it is that communal thing where you think, well, someone else is going to address climate change. I don't have to do my role. Someone else will take over. And everyone becomes complicit in what's happening.
And so what you're saying applies as much today to our world and our times as it did back in those days, right?
Well, you know, we fortunately no longer have this belief in witchcraft, which I should say, by the way, is a religious idea in the 17th century. It's not an idea of superstition. It comes hand in hand with the piety of New England, this idea that witches existed. But yes, that ability to, or that interest in shaming someone publicly or ganging up on someone, as we now do increasingly on social media, as I think, you know, very much, very familiar to us. And in that sense that a community can be purified somehow by some people being singled out, something that we've seen, you know, in our own times, absolutely.
That we're still prone to the kinds of behaviors that you talk about in this book. Do you find that discouraging about the plight of humankind?
I think part of the way I made it through this Puritan wilderness, and this was a book that obviously took years, was looking at who the heroes are, because you do ultimately hear those voices of dissent. And they're not, the people who speak up are not the people you would have expected to speak up. And when they do so with tremendous nobility and tremendous eloquence. And you do see reason finally triumphing in this, you know, at the end of this particular chapter. So there is an affirming end to the story. What there also is, curiously, is a silence over what happened, because there is such shame and regret afterwards that there's a sort of conspiracy of silences afterward. No one wants to talk about what happened. No one wants to talk about those 19 people who hanged and those two dogs. People really want to make the thing go away. And so you see that the record is essentially expunged afterward. Whole whole months are gone from people's diaries. Letters go missing. One of the great Massachusetts ministers' sermon book, we have nothing. We have a blank for that summer, for the summer of 1692. Hmm. It's almost as if this just everyone tries to rip the pages from the record.
And I bet that just kills someone like you who is an historian and would just die to see exactly what you just described. What a loss.
You know, there's nothing worse than sitting in an archive and you're reading, you know, the great New England minister's diary, and he's recorded every detail of colonial life. You know, his dog was sick, and then, you know, the villagers delivered beans to his house, and then he had a haircut. And you turn the page from 1691 to 1692, and you realize that the entire year is missing. So, yes, it's the historian's worst nightmare.
What do you think happened there? Did Salem get together in surrounding communities and sort of have a town hall meeting and say, this was really bad, we got to get rid of any trace of this? Or what do you suspect happened?
Well, that's a conjectural thing. I don't think there's a conspiracy going on here. I think everyone, as always is the case, has his reasons. The primary set of documents that are missing are the court papers. We have the depositions from the examining sessions that were taken earlier. We have arrest warrants. We have confessions, many confessions, because many people confess to witchcraft. We have jailers' accountings. We don't have the trial papers. And, you know, there you can say, well, that's really, you know, interesting. There must have been some conspiracy. But, in fact, they may simply have gone missing. And one of the theories is that they were, in fact, destroyed during the Stamp Act riots, which would have been rather ironic. But, you know, we just don't know how these things all slipped out of the record. What is clear is that no one really, either among the accusers or the accused, has any reason to want to remember this particular chapter.
Stacey Schiff.
It's really Arthur Miller who brings it back.
Oh, okay. And he was the one who sort of brought him, because I was going to say so many books have been written about this, like 500, right?
A lot, yeah, yeah. I think
did
it's
you read
the
them
crucible,
all?
Though, that, no, but
not
I did.
Quite.
I read the papers backwards and forwards, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Stacey Schiff is my guest. She'll talk about her book, The Witches, at a Rainy Day Books author event at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza at 6:30 Monday evening. More information and to reserve a seat, rainydaybooks.com is a good place to go. If you want to join our conversation here, 816-235-2888 is the number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So why did you go back and decide to write a book about Salem and the witch trials? You've written about Cleopatra, you've written about other prominent women, but this topic had been covered a bunch. Why did you want to add to it?
Well, in part, it seemed to me one of those seminal stories. I mean, the ramifications of this particular episode are enormous. In part, I couldn't find the book I wanted on the shelf, which I guess is one of the reasons we always want to, you know, you always want to write a book because the one you want to read is missing. And I wanted to know what it felt like to live in early modern America. What were these supposedly bewitched girls thinking? What were the apprehensions and the dreams of an early American? Why did people suddenly think they saw witches flitting around? What does it smell like? What is the dark like? Because the dark is a real character in this story. There's this velvety, disorienting black. And, you know, when you can get turned around in your own field on the way home, you begin to understand something at a very vulnerable time, you begin to understand something of the fear that contributes to this epidemic of witchcraft.
Well, let's talk about the story a little bit. And one thing we do know is that this story begins in January of 1692, obviously the dead of winter in New England, in the Salem home of Minister Samuel Parris. What happened to his two girls at that time?
These two girls begin to convulse and to fall into trances and to seemingly fly across the room and interrupt sermons, by the way, which was a big no-no, and show signs of what was by many people understood to be witchcraft. There had been an earlier case of in Boston 3 years earlier, 4 years earlier, in another family where a set of children suffered similar convulsions, and they had been understood to have been bewitched, and in fact, a woman hanged on Boston Common for having tortured those poor children. So it took a little while, but fairly soon after these symptoms break out, it's understood that these girls are suffering from witchcraft, and they name the names of three women who they say are witches.
And what happens then?
Well, one of those women, and this is really what sets off the sort of firestorm, one of those women will confess to witchcraft. And once there is which is very rare. There had been plenty of prior accusations of witchcraft before, but rarely had there been a confession. And once someone actively says she is practicing witchcraft, and in her case that she has accomplices and that she's flown to Boston to consult with them and that she's met with the devil, then grown men begin to see strange creatures in the nighttime, and other people begin to experience symptoms, including adult women and men as well. And a frenzy sort of is set off, which will lead to a number of other confessions, and a very, very vivid sort of kaleidoscopic story about a diabolical conspiracy against the church and the state of the colony.
And you get a sense of these people, and I think you have a great analogy in the book. There are as many people in New England back in those days as might fill Yankee Stadium today, meaning not a whole lot, right?
And it's not a whole lot. So that when you get a town, and many towns were affected by these by this epidemic, when you get a town like Andover, for example, one in 10 or 12 people is accused of witchcraft.
Wow.
You really, you know, the numbers are, the numbers sound small to us, but, you know, 19 people is a lot given the relative sparseness of the population of New England at the time.
Is there a possible medical explanation for what might have happened to the daughters of Samuel Parris?
You know, we've gone through a number of, cycled through a number of medical theories over the years, none of which holds up, partly when you think about it, certain children in certain families are affected in certain kids are not. These children tend to be perfectly fine at some times and, you know, madly convulsing at other times. When they see, when they seemingly hallucinate or they see signs of witchcraft, they tend to see biblical images, which, you know, there would have been an enormous array. They seem to tend to see similar biblical images. There would have been a whole array of hallucinating if you were really simply hallucinating. But I think we go back to those medical answers because we like an answer that will exonerate everyone in the story. And if there were a medical explanation for this, everyone's hands would be a little bit more clean. But it does point to, I think, one of the reasons we continually go back to Salem. We want a solution. We want an answer. This thing that we can't quite get our minds around that still baffles us is something we want to put to rest.
You know, this furor that developed, you know, back then is just astonishing to me. And some of these details were so intriguing. I mean, we're talking about wives and daughters denouncing husbands and fathers. We're talking about husbands implicating wives, brothers and sisters pointing their fingers at each other. I mean, this thing just went nuts, right?
Yes, and that's what makes you wonder about what could have happened afterwards, because you get whole families riven apart by these accusations. And in one case, there's a 72-year-old grandmother who's dragged into court and at first denies that she could be a witch in any way, and then her daughter comes in and accuses her, and then her granddaughter comes in and says, yes, both my mother and my grandmother are witches.
Wow.
So how did those three people, actually only two of them survive, how do they go back to living with each other after the trials are over? And you get ministers accusing their parishioners and parishioners accusing their ministers. I should say that among those 19 victims is a Harvard-educated minister who is thought to be the sort of mastermind behind all this, behind this entire conspiracy.
You know, this notion that the darkness was a character in this story is really intriguing to me, because I think, you know, Stacy, that our ability to picture what it was like in a harsh winter back in 1692 in the Boston area, that's very hard for us to imagine today in this era of electricity and everything else. I mean, this was a pretty bleak environment, right?
Yes, and you know, there's a theory. The other thing, in addition to the darkness, is especially for women, there would have been a sense of claustrophobia at the end of a winter. They've been indoors all winter. The men have been outdoors a great deal more. And they've been indoors in what would have been very undecorated, very plain homes, because there is no imagery really for them to look at in a Puritan world. There's very little decoration of any kind. So we're talking about a really desolate, bleak interior, which modern science tells us is the kind of situation that makes you start to imagine things, because your imagination has no place to go. Your visual mind has nothing on which to settle. And that, you know, may have something to do with what these girls are beginning to see, but certainly it's a cramped, cold end of winter, and there's a particular strain on their household because the minister at the heart of the crisis is at odds with his community. So the girls have been hearing lots of complaints about their father and uncle, and they've been seeing sort of aggrieved parishioners stomping in and out of the house for the weeks before they begin to convulse.
Hmm. You know, people in those days were supposed to believe in witchcraft. Do I have that right?
Absolutely. And I think that's the hardest part of the story to get our minds around.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's that the Bible tells us, I mean, part of the understanding here of how we're certain witches exist is that the Bible tells us you are not to let a witch survive. So doesn't that imply that there is such a thing as witchcraft? And for most everyone in New England, since most everyone is a Puritan at this point, that is an incontrovertible fact. A witch exists as plainly as does heat or light. And it is especially important to the ministry, who are in many ways the authorities here, to make sure that belief continues. So they are not entirely out of sorts with this idea of a witchcraft crisis, because it's a very attractive way of confirming New England piety. And it seems to them, by the way, that it's a badge of honor that the devil has chosen them for this great trial. So there, too, they're somewhat embracing this madness because they feel that there's a sign here, there's a divine sign here that this is the chosen people.
And it's also for us to imagine today just how much time people back in those days spent at church. I mean, we're talking about people who were immersed in it. You had some number like, 15,000 hours by the time, people spend listening to sermons during the course of their adult life. Tell us about that part of this.
Yeah, I think I absorbed all those 15,000 hours when I was researching this book.
Did you turn into a witch? Yeah.
what becomes very clear early on is that this is an immensely literate society. And one of the reasons, of course, it's literate is that in order to pray, you had to know how to read. Even these kids are literate. Many of them can't write, but almost all of them can read. And they have all, of course, read the same text, which means that the imagery is very consistent from one person to another. So yes, they've absorbed massive numbers of sermons, and you begin to see the imagery from some of those sermons turned on its head in some of the accounts of the witchcraft, because this rather demented sounding to us story of how these witches are planning this conspiracy gets embroidered as it moves from one person to the next person to the next person. And it takes on a lot of imagery which people have picked up, obviously, in meeting when they've gone to hear various ministers. And that's one of the more interesting things. You see the sort of game of telephone being played as you travel, yes, as you move through the book. And you see really vivid details being attached to this. You know, people crashing on their sticks as they're flying to diabolical Sabbaths, and people describing their conversations with the devil and describing what the devil's, the book the devil offers them to sign looked like, and talking about what kind of ink they signed it in, and things like that.
We're talking about the Salem Witch Trials with Stacy Schiff, and who author of the book The Witches, now out in paperback. I mean, maybe a silly question, but do you wish, having spent as much time as you did on this topic, I mean, would you like to have been there and sort of watch all this transpire, or was it so horrifying and off-putting that it would have been the last place you ever would have wanted to spend some time?
I think you always want to have been there because, you walk away with so many unanswered questions. I mean, why did they accuse their former minister? You know, why did so-and-so confess? Why, there are so many unanswered questions. At the same time, you would have wanted a very quick ticket out of there. You know, it gets very hot and very sticky very quickly, and you begin to see the frenzy with which the speed with which this frenzy spreads, and realize that everyone is soon about to be trapped in it.
And again, there's so much we don't know here. You wonder if 8 or 9 of the people from Salem would join us in a roundtable conversation today, if they might not sit back and say, oh, no, you guys have got it way wrong. You know, you just haven't got it right.
I think they would be startled by our inability to grasp their sense of the world. You know, mm-hmm. We've come to explain the world so very differently. And, you know, we go back to this for that same gnawing reason. We're just trying to figure out, who took the kitchen scissors? And their answer to that question was, witchcraft. We think, it was probably, your little sister.
The witch hunts would go on to last 9 months. How well organized were they? And describe what that was about.
Well, the witchcraft accusations begin when there's no seated government. So they don't really have a way to adjudicate the charges until a couple of months into the crisis. A court is seated in the middle of the summer. 9 justices are appointed to it. And they actually proceed according to the letter of the law. There's no legal demand here that they ignore. The problem is they don't really have the forensics down. It's very hard to figure out how to determine who is a witch and whether he or she really meant to practice his witchcraft. The problem is that the Chief Justice is a stern believer in witchcraft, gives the jury extremely specific instructions, basically saying to them, you don't have to determine that the girls were hurt. You only have to determine that the accused had the intention of practicing witchcraft on them. And the girls are in the courtroom day after day, and I should say that those initial symptoms will prove contagious and that there'll be a whole circle of afflicted adolescent and pre-adolescent girls. And they're in the courtroom day after day when the court is in session, collapsing and screaming and writhing and showing abrasions on their arms and with blood streaming out of their mouths. And it's a pretty certain sign to anyone who believes in witchcraft that these girls are actually enchanted in some way. So that's sort of exhibit A for the prosecution. It's very hard to get around that.
Or at least the girls themselves came to believe that they were witches.
Exactly. And wow. and what is actually afflicting them is something we will never know. I think the greater mystery is why is the court proceeding with such, and there are many reasons for it, why is the court proceeding so relentlessly?
You know, is it true, Stacey, that every single defendant who actually confessed to witchcraft wound up being spared? It was only those claiming innocence who were executed?
Yes, it's true. And there seems to be this realization that confession was a way of escaping the gallows toward midsummer. And, of course, that adds to the number of confessions, as does the fact that if you confess, you sort of simultaneously can accuse. So you can say, you know, I confess, and by the way, it was my neighbor who recruited me, and therefore you've handed the justices what they're looking for. So you become very valuable to the court system. So, yes, there becomes this rash of confessions in part because there seems to have been this understanding that it was a way toward clemency.
Nearly 200 people were imprisoned. Tell us about some of them and why they wound up being imprisoned.
Well, pretty much anyone who's accused is immediately rounded up and carted off to prison. And the prisons were particularly dank, dark, and primitive places. Just in an added irony, in early New England, if you were imprisoned, you paid for your own jail charges. You paid for your own bedding and your own food. So we have extremely meticulous accounting from the jailers because, of course, they want to be reimbursed for their expenses. So we know precisely who went to jail when and how long he or she stayed and, you know, where he or she stayed. There were dungeons in the prison as well, and the most dangerous prisoners, like the minister I mentioned who's thought to be the mastermind, those prisoners are put in the dungeon. But people are crammed in very closely, one next to another. And the result of that is that, of course, the story begins to take on a certain, it becomes very cogent because they're sharing notes essentially on what they've mentioned. So someone can go into prison having said one thing and come out with exactly the same story that someone else had mentioned the previous week because, of course, she heard it in prison. And this gives, of course, the authorities the idea that there is this very cohesive narrative because, of course, everyone is repeating the same facts. So in a funny way, the proximity of the prisoners very much undermines the ability to get at the truth here. And it's interesting to see someone, you know, go into prison and then come out with a completely different tale.
You know, there's a couple stories about individuals involved in this that will really help bring this whole thing alive a little bit. And these stories are just, you know, knee bucklers. Is it Giles Corey? Am I saying his name right?
Giles Corey.
Tell us his story.
This is actually the anniversary of his death. It was just a few days ago, so he's on my mind. Giles Corey is the only person who refuses to play along, essentially, with the court when asked to enter a plea. And you had, by law, to enter a plea of either innocent or guilty. And he refuses to even answer the question. As far as I can tell, I've found one earlier case in which that happens. And when the defendant is told that he will be crushed under stones if he doesn't enter a plea, he finally concedes and he enters a guilty plea. That was a piracy case. With Giles Corey, he refuses to answer.
Refuses,
he remains mute.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Refuses, absolutely. And so, in fact, he suffers this horrific death where he is laid out in the jail yard and boards are put upon him and stones are piled upon the boards. And over the next day or two, he is crushed to death by the added stones. Because he refuses to enter a plea in court. He's the only person in New England history, in American history, who suffers that terrible fate. But he's just absolutely adamant about not giving the court what it's asking for. And his wife is also an accused witch, and she would have been alive at the time of that. Well, she hangs a few days later, but she would have been alive at the time of that torture, in fact.
not a way you want to go. I can't imagine a worse way.
No, no,
and then there's 5-year-old Dorothy Good. Tell us her story.
She's a little beggar woman's child, and she's very, you know, the accusations run the gamut here, from the richest merchant in Salem is accused of witchcraft, and he escapes. And then there's little Dorothy Good, who's 5 years old and homeless, and her mother is accused. And witchcraft was understood to be to run along matrilineal lines, so the little girl is also accused. And many of the girls who are bewitched will say that she bites them, and they'll show off these tiny little bite marks on their arms. And she'll go to jail with her mother, and she will survive, in fact. She doesn't hang. The mother will. And we know from her father that she'll require care for the rest of her life. She's clearly, you know, utterly undone by that time in prison, probably by losing her mother as well. But she's the youngest of the accused.
Hmm. And doesn't she wear little manacles for much of her time?
Yes, there's a chilling note, and when I say the jailer's records are extremely complete, there's a chilling note among the jailer's accounting where he talks about having purchased miniature manacles for the child prisoner, and you know, small blankets and miniature manacles for her.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Chris from Kansas City, Missouri. Chris, you're on Up to Date with Stacy Schiff. Good morning.
Hi, Stacy. I'm curious. I'm a neuropsychiatrist, and I just happened to catch this on the radio as I'm driving. And
yeah.
For some time, we've been looking at this phenomenon, and we pretty much have come to a clear conclusion that you're dealing with mass religious hysteria, some Briquet's or histrionic personality disorder, and some of the other disorders that go with these kind of issues, such as folie à deux or folie à trois or a mass kind of paranoid disorder. And mm-hmm. Here you see very clearly where fear and belief trumps facts and reason, which you also see in today's political environment where
yes.
people crucifying other people. It's exactly the same process. So I'm curious about what your thoughts are on this.
Hmm.
It's a perfect and somewhat eerie parallel, isn't it? And that's why I said there felt to me some urgency about writing about this right now, because it just seems to be sort of beckoning to us from the headlines. There was another case, you probably remember it, in upstate New York a few years ago, where a group of cheerleaders began to suffer very similar symptoms to what the Salem girls had suffered. And I don't think there was ever any diagnosis. This went on for quite some time. It was in Leroy, New York. And I don't think there was ever ultimately a diagnosis as to what they were suffering from, although something that was true in both cases is that the more these children were observed, the more intense their symptoms. And once the media circus moved out of Leroy, New York, these girls did find some relief. And you do see that with the Salem. There's a later Salem case, later Massachusetts case, where a girl essentially asks for the entire panoply of New England ministers to come visit her at her bedside. And she suffers tremendously. And when they leave, she seems to be in perfectly good health.
Stacy, just a final point, and people might be wondering this. How did you research a book like this, given the fact that so many of the records were gone? What did you do?
Well, I started with the papers. There are about 1,000 pieces of paper in the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, which as I say, are the depositions, the confessions, the arrest warrants, pretty much every piece of paper we have dealing with the trials. There are things elsewhere, but that's the bulk of the original stuff. And then we do have diaries. Cotton Mather and Increase Mather, who were the two ministers at the center of the crisis, left an enormous amount of paper and diaries and letters, really fabulous letters.
Mm.
And then there's just this, there's in my office a mountain of Puritan sermons. And you see a lot of the imagery that you'll need to understand this is in those sermons. And there are very few correspondences, but there are some letters among the various authorities involved here as well. And that's pretty much it for primary documentation. There were no newspapers in 17th century Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And you can read what the New Englander, him or herself, would have read. So you have the books that they would have had at hand explaining witchcraft to them.
Stacy Schiff will be talking about her book, The Witches, at a Rainy Day Books author event at the Kansas City Public Library on the Plaza, 6:30 Monday evening. More information, rainydaybooks.com. Stacy, what a great story. A great story for our times as well. And really appreciate you taking some time.
Thanks, Steve. My pleasure.